Okay, it's official. I'm welcoming you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education. So glad you're here tonight. Tuesday evenings is a weekly lecture series, and we have three more. We finish up on November 18th this season. And next week, Fionn Mead is here to share insights and experiences as the recently hired Walker Art Center's first senior curator of cross-disciplinary platforms. He's also acting department head of visual arts there at the Walker, as well as a longtime independent curator, a writer, and editor who has collaborated with a really interesting array of established and emerging artists. I'm excited about Fionn, and I encourage you to come back. Get online and look him up. I think you'll be interested in what he does. I'm happy to report that tonight, in conjunction with the Modern's current exhibition, Urban Theater, New York in the 1980s, we are fortunate to have with us the artist of Cosmic Closet, circa 1981, one of the exhibition's most popular works, which curator Michael Opping has described as a surreal three-dimensional landscape that could also be thought of as a theater in the round, thus making it perfect for urban theater. The artist I'm speaking of course, is Kenny Scharf. I'm not telling you anything. You all came to see him. And I know you're excited. Kenny was born in Hollywood and then moved to New York, where he earned his BFA from the School of Visual Arts in 1980. He now divides his time between LA and New York and sometimes Brazil. As a young artist in New York, he was quickly part of the East Village art scene with his friend and roommate Keith Haring. Kenny participated in many of the seminal alternative exhibitions of the time, including the Times Square show in 1980, and solo exhibitions such as his show at the Fun Gallery in 1981 launched his international career. In 1984, Kenny's work was included in the Venice Biennale as well as the 1995 Whitney Biennial. Of course, this was the beginning of what has become and still is a long and productive career. More recently, solo exhibitions have included Hodgepodge in 2012 at Honor Fraser Gallery, where Kenny is represented in LA, Kenny Scharf Colors with a K at Paul Kasman Gallery in New York in 2013, and this year, Kenny Scharf at Coulette in Paris. Kenny's work has been included in too many group exhibitions for me to account for all of them in this introduction, but I will mention the Media Sensation, the first major U.S. museum survey of graffiti and street art, Art in the Streets, curated by Jeffrey Deitch at MoCA in 2011. I think some of you may have had the fortune of actually seeing that exhibition, so I wanted to bring it up. And Kenny's work, of course, is included in major private and museum collections, all of which only touches on what has been a very impressive career. What is probably more important, however, is what is behind this work. Kenny Scharf is an enthusiastic and generous artist who agrees not only to do lectures like this evening, but also to work with young artists such as the Modern's talented group of students chosen for our teen artist program, which he did this Sunday. Many of whom I think are in the audience tonight, I'm happy to say. To further my point and to conclude this intro, I quote, "My personal ambition has always been to live the example. I believe the artist has a social responsibility to engage others in a thought process that ultimately brings art to everyday life, thereby enhancing the quality of our experience." With that, please join me in welcoming Kenny Scharf.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for having me. I'm a little bit nervous, but once I get going, I'll be fine. So I have a lot of stuff to talk about, but I'm trying to limit it because I've been doing this for too long and we'd be here forever. So I'm going to just start a little bit from my earlier days. This is a piece I did. I was in high school, I grew up in LA, and I obviously was influenced by my surroundings. I should remember the name of this piece, but I don't. I don't know if there's anything I need to say. It's pretty apparent what's going on here. So, burning, earthquakes, fires, part of the world that I grew up in. More of the early days in LA. These structures are car washes, some of my favorite buildings in LA. That Ships is a coffee shop, and then probably you recognize the 76 gasoline station. So growing up in LA in the 60s, I'm from the 50s, I was very much influenced by my surroundings, and the architecture and everything around me screamed, "You're going to outer space." And I really believed it. So when all the cars look like they're going to take off and the architecture looks like it's in outer space, it was a time that was filled with fantasy, and I really clicked on that fantasy. This painting is, I think, the first paintings are all from the 70s. So we're going to go a little bit in this early work. That is a self-portrait. So I've been a Finn fanatic ever since I was a little kid. I remember being in the back seat of my parents' car. We didn't have seat belts back then. They didn't exist. So I remember all the cars having, you know, just really made an effect on me. You know, when you look at these 50s and early 60s cars, they're filled with this fantasy and this kind of optimism about the future and the space age that was just beginning. So this painting I did right before I moved to New York. And basically, it's telling the story of who I thought I was or am. A space age guy. My name actually, at the time, I named myself when I moved to New York, Jet. Which is now the name of my grandson. So here's a painting I did my first year in college. I was going to UC Santa Barbara. I did this in my dorm room. And I thought this painting was a good one to show because it kind of represents a lot of what my philosophy and my inspiration about where we are as a culture. Here is this woman. This is called Barbara Simpson's New Kitchen. She is very happy. She's showing off her new pink kitchen, and she's oblivious that there's a dragon coming out of the sink, which in a way is kind of like how I view a lot of how people live then and also today, where we are going through our lives, we are consuming, we are being happy, but at the same time there's like monsters in our midst. And I'm very aware, I'm actually an optimist, but at the same time, I'm always thinking about the danger and the scary side. So I kind of like the excitement of the opposites. This is her husband. I did this in the dorm room too. This is George Simpson barbecuing. And the reason he's barbecuing in the bathroom is because outside is completely full of nuclear radiation and you can't go outside anymore. But he doesn't seem to mind, does he? He's just barbecuing. Got plants growing out of his sink in his bathtub. Oh, and by the way, anyone who wants to ask any questions while I'm talking, please feel free. This is the start of a series of paintings that I did when I first moved to New York. About 2 months after I arrived, I was very lucky. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of a store in New York called Fiorucci. It was a store on 59th Street, and it was more than a store. It was kind of like a scene. It was a daytime disco. I've never really seen anything like it, where in the daytime, everyone's there, and it's a real happening, a real scene. So I was offered this show right off. I walked into Fiorucci with a friend of mine, and I don't know, maybe it was something about the way I look, but immediately started talking to the people there. One, does anyone know who Joey Arias is? He's a performer. He was working there. He kind of grabbed me and learned about my art, and next thing I knew, I was having a show there. It was called Fiorucci Celebrates the New Wave, 1979. So this series is called it's the story of Estelle. This woman is named Estelle. I'm not going to show all of this series, but just a little taste of it. She's having a pizza party. Why is there these TVs on top of her pizza? Because the aliens are coming out of the TVs on the pizza. And what are the aliens doing? They gave her a one-way ticket to outer space. So there she is, she's ready, she's got her bag packed, and she's about to get in her Dodge, and there's a Cadillac flying. She's a jet-set woman of the future. She gets in her car, and she's inside. She's looking out the window. It says, the title of this one is Escaped in Time, I'm Pleased. She escaped the annihilation of the Earth by the nuclear bombs. Yes?
I just wanted to ask, what materials did you use to create these pieces?
These pieces are acrylic with an airbrush. Back then, I was very influenced by the time that I was painting and living in, which was airbrush art was kind of the thing, which later came in handy when I started using the spray can. This is kind of a very similar technique. So she's quite pleased. She's the only survivor. She doesn't seem to mind it because she escaped. And she's watching the bomb go off on TV in space. And there she is, flying around all by herself, very happy. Okay, this is going to the next chapter. That's the end of the Estelle series. Basically, I'm not going to read this all to you, but this is something that I, kind of a philosophy of mine, that I wrote in 1981, which is the top part, and then there's a little addendum in 1983. And what I did was, it's explanation for this new religion called Jetsonism. And Jetsonism is basically what's going to happen. Okay, one of the things that I was obsessed with, and I guess I still am, is the end of the world. At the time, growing up from the 50s, well, born in the 50s, but growing up, you know, we had the drills, the alarm, you know, everyone get under your desks, get ready for the nuclear bomb. Like getting under your desk is really going to help if the bomb's going off. But that's what we were told to do. So there was always this underlying fear that the bomb was going to go off any moment. And it kind of is a theme that I'm obsessed with. There's a lot of things I'm obsessed with, but the bomb is definitely one of the things that captivates me. So basically, what do you do when the bomb goes off? Well, you put your hands up like that, and if you're good, you go straight to the good place. And if you're bad, well, you probably know what happens if you're bad. And it's weird because I just made this up on my own, but it's a little bit like, what's that called? It's part of the, when, like a, the new Christianity, when people, the rapture. It's a little bit like the rapture, which I thought was really strange, but it is. And I talk about mandalas and symbology. There was a book that I was very fascinated with, that I still am, called Man and His Symbols by Carl Jung. And it really influenced me a lot and taught me about mandalas and the meaning of mandalas. And actually, I should have shown some other mandalas, but I didn't. And then in the second part, oh, by the way, the term of, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term, I'm sure you have, pop surrealism. Well, I'm going to claim I made up the term. Here we are, 1981. I name it pop surrealism. I'm not sure I like the direction that it's gone completely, because I feel like people have, it's kind of become synonymous with lowbrow. Not that I think lowbrow's bad, but it's kind of been taken over by a lowbrow kind of mentality. But pop surrealism, what it really means is, in when I made it up, is that what I think is that I am coming from a surrealist place where you're bringing things up from your subconscious as a surrealist. But growing up, when I did, being bombarded with imagery and media and all this stuff, that these images, a lot of cartoons and media images, became part of my subconscious. So when I started working or painting and creating as a surrealist, the imagery was infused with pop, which is inside of me. It's not like the pop artist from the 60s were basically, let's say you take the Andy Warhol soup can, he took it off the shelves and said, look, everyday objects can be art. And it's basically looking at it from an outsider point of view and like an outside stance. Well, what I did was different. It's coming from inside me. So really, what is a surrealism? Because it's full of pop imagery, pop surrealism. So the second part is about this character called L. Fredericks. And L. Fredericks is a conglomeration of Fred Flintstone, who is the ancestor, and Elroy Jetson, which comes from the future. So what happened was, and I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm just going to tell you all this stuff. The future and the past collided. When the future and the past collided, it created a time splat, which is all time, no time, every time, which is chaos. And when chaos occurs, that is when creativity and creation happens. So I created, in the very early part of my career, I was doing images directly taken from the Jetsons, as you see in the show. I have Fred and I have the Flintstones and the Jetsons. And then when the time splat occurred, everything mutated and became these characters, which are kind of, well, not kind of, which are my own characters, which are mutations from the future and the past. And the reason why Ix is in there is because of Felix the cat. I just like Felix. I threw him in there. Okay, so we're going to jump into customization. Customization is something I started back in the late 70s, early 80s. What it really started was my fascination with trash and garbage, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. And I was mostly interested in picking up things that I would see in the street, TVs and electronic appliances. And I loved those things because they had a science fiction feel. I'm obsessed with 50s science fiction. They also have an obsession with a nuclear bomb, the end of the world, and all that kind of stuff. And another thing I love, the thing about customization, it has to do with taking everyday objects that we all use and turning them into art. Therefore, you're taking art into your everyday life. So one thing I'm a believer in is that art should be part of your life, not only something designated for a wall in a gallery, in a museum, which are great places for art, and I'm very happy to be hanging in a museum, don't get me wrong. But I also believe that in order to bring art into the real life, you've got to get it out into the real life. And that's why I like to do murals, and I like to paint cars, and I like to do appliances. And customization has to do with appliances. And I also look at it, it correlates a little bit to the ancients. So when you look at the ancient civilizations, Egyptians and the Greeks, the Romans, all of their everyday objects, their urns, whatever it is that they were using, they were adorned with art. And it seemed to be such a wonderful, rich way to live your life. If every day you're actually using the object and it is art, then you take that art and you bring it into your life. So this was my music. This was one of the things I listened to. And if you go see the show, there's a telephone. That was my telephone that I used. There was a Walkman. I don't know if the older people know what Walkmans are. There was a manicure set. Not that I used a manicure set. It was just something that I like. It was an appliance that I found. But I customized everything you can imagine. I even had a little business for myself. Back before I started selling paintings, I had a business. One of my alter egos, I have a few, is called Van Chrome. And Van Chrome had a customization service, and I would go to people's homes, and let's say, first I started doing it at friends' homes, thinking hopefully that I could, somebody who had some money who might want to hire me, might want to hire me to customize their appliances, and actually it did work. So what I would do is someone would call me and they'd say, can you please do my telephone? I said, of course. Came to their house. I said, the telephone's $200. And they'd look around the house and I'd say, if I can do that TV and your blender for an extra $200. And so I would spend the day at these people's homes and do various appliances. That's a hair dryer. That's the other side. So this was an early one because it's the Jetsons. So it was actually a business that I had of Van Chrome's customization. Early TV. We're going back. This is like 1981. The ultimate, well, not the ultimate, but one of the ultimate appliances is a car. Here is a Cadillac, 1959. Oh, God, what's the name of it? The Altima? No, that's not the Altima Suprema. Oh, well. It's got a good name, but I can't remember right now. This car obviously was beautiful to begin with. I don't always take these beautiful cars and add to them. I often will take an ugly car and improve it. But here I'm taking the ultimate mobile and customizing it. That's the trunk. If you turn the lights off, that disco ball goes, and there's actually a turntable and music in there. It's an instant disco. That's a little bit of the interior. Now, here's something that relates to the cars. It's called car bombs. I actually happened to do 3 car bombs today in the parking lot. I've done over 100 car bombs. It's something that I have been doing for the past year and a half. It started when I was doing a mural, actually down in Alabama, of all places. Someone drove up and said, hey, will you paint on my car? So I painted the car, and then I took a picture of that, put it on Instagram when I was back in Brooklyn, and I wrote, hey, everybody, I'm doing cars. Bring me your car. Bring me the car. By the way, it's absolutely free. Bring me the car. Put that on Instagram, and it started snowballing. So it's become this thing that I do, which is a lot of fun, and it's my way of getting out into the real world, as I said, as part of my philosophy. And also, another aspect that I like about car bombs, the fact that it's free, is I feel that today in the art world, there's too much focus on how much money something goes for. And that's not why I became an artist. That's not what I'm about. Not that I say that I'm not happy being able to sell art and live off my art and support my family and everything like that. But I want the focus to become back to art. And so one of the reasons why I do the public art, the murals, and the car bombs is that there is no money involved. It's out there. It's for everybody. And so here's a little, oh, and then a little celebrity thing and connecting to the show. This is Cindy Sherman's car. I did that last summer. So she's a car bomb victim, as I like to say. And then the ultimate appliance is the jet plane. Now, this is a project in a, have you ever heard of a boneyard? It's a place where airplanes go to die, jet planes go to die, or any airplane. There's the Boneyard Project. This is in Tucson. I did this last spring. And then the next thing I'm going to click on, it's a little three-minute film about the Boneyard Project.
Sputnik went up.
Fire.
Pretty much my whole childhood was, we're going to go to space. We get to buy a ticket at a certain point, and we get to go. This was always something that I dreamed of and I believed. And then the 70s hit. The fantasy of space travel just left. I wanted to keep it going. So I have this fascination with the visions of the future gone south. This is nice and pleasant right now.
Take a look.
I think I've done a lot. I realize I have a lot to do.
Juan, we know how to dance.
Juan, sabemos bailar.
Graffiti, thug, hippie types. And now they're in penis and planes, and now they're just sitting out there. Check
it out.
I never know what I'm going to do. It just... kind of do it.
That's another aspect of a lot of the work I'm going to show is, or that I do, is I don't plan it. There's really no drawings that I do beforehand. I like to rely on spontaneity, or something I like to call magic, where you just let it happen, and it's almost like something is coming from outside of me and entering me, and I let it happen. So there's a certain excitement and also anxiety and a little scary about not knowing what's going to happen, especially like, you know, you're painting someone's car like today. You don't want to screw up because it's their car. And also with spray paint, you don't erase it. You don't get to go back and undo it. So you're taking a lot of chances. And that's one of the things that I really like is putting myself into that place where I have that kind of fear and anxiety, but it's also excitement. So I'm always wanting to keep myself in that exciting place. This image relates to the installation I did. This is at the Sogetsu Museum in Tokyo. I think it's about 20 years ago. One of the cosmic caverns or closets, or there's a few different names I have for it. Then this one took place at Arnold Fraser Gallery, I think it was a couple years ago, which is pretty similar to the one we have here. All of this stuff, I'd say 90% of it is stuff I find in the garbage. And I am fascinated with garbage. I'm always looking around in the street for garbage. And by the way, there's hardly any garbage in the street here. I was like, it's so clean. And there's hardly any graffiti. I'm like, wow. I don't know if I could survive. But I'm fascinated with that kind of thing. And I feel like garbage tells such a story about us as a society, what we throw away. And I'm obsessed with it. And part of what this is almost like all the stuff that we get comes at us all the time. I feel like it's way too much, so I have to throw it up. And there it is. And I love blacklight. The whole thing started, I was living with roommates with Keith Haring, and we had a kind of a dilapidated townhouse in Times Square, and I found this closet in this old weird house. Not that I'm... Oh, let me go back. And I just started collecting this garbage, sticking it in, and I got a hold of a black light just by chance and started painting a fluorescent, and it just started like that. And then it's become this thing that I do, and I love to do it. Here's a painting called The Fun's Inside. This is 1983. So I also make paintings on canvas besides the customization, and since we're basically talking about the 80s, here's some another painting. And as I said, anyone that wants to ask questions, call them. Here's a painting called When the Worlds Collide. This is owned by the Whitney Museum. It has a lot to do with cartoons, obviously, surrealism. The dots kind of remind me when I was a very young child. We got our color television. I must have been 5 years old, the first color TV. And all the people my age or older might remember the very first color TVs. If you sat this close in front of the screen, there are basically millions of colored dots on a black ground. And instead of watching the show, I would actually look at the light show. And I'd be like that close and just watching this light show. And my mom would go like, don't sit that front and close to the TV. And I'm like, okay. But basically, I was really into sitting an inch away from the TV. Might have affected something about me, maybe. And then here's a detail. If you look, oh, I have a pointer, I forgot. Now, if you notice, that is a Keith Haring baby. And the reason why that's in this painting is because I had no studio at the time, and Keith went away, and he gave me a studio, and I made this painting in a studio. So it was kind of like a thank you to him. Okay, here we go. Segue into a more recent donut painting. This painting is about the same size as you're seeing it. I'm fascinated, obsessed with donuts. There's so much about the donut that I love. Obviously, they taste really good. They look really good. They're really bad for you. And they have holes. And I also like the thing about donuts is there is a scientific theory out there that the universe is shaped like a donut. Maybe it is. So here is another painting, a little more recent, maybe could be, I don't know, 8 years old, is a diptych. This is basically an appropriation. This was a double page spread in a magazine, and really all I did was copy it. But what it represented was that whole dream, that whole idea that was fed to me as a child about the future and about how our design elements that was part of my everyday life was feeding me this fantasy, and most people just took it for fantasy, and as I mentioned before, I really believed it. So when the fantasy died, I decided that's not really very fair. I'm going to keep this going. So now, going a little bit to another subject, which is mural making. When I moved to New York in the late 70s, I already had this whole vocabulary about cartoons and using airbrush, and I quickly became immersed in the street culture. So this was my first mural, my first actually attempt at spray painting, and this was on a handball court, or not a handball court, this was I don't actually remember where it was. But it was a long time ago. And then this is something that after my dear friend Keith Haring died, there was all these handball courts on the Upper West Side and the West Side Highway that different artists who were friends of Keith made these paintings. And then this was my tribute to Keith. It says tribute to Keith. And the reason why there's all these little lines on it was because you can see there's a little tagging on it. It kind of discouraged the tagging, so I kind of gave it a little close. But I've been using Keith's baby incorporated into my work for a little bit of time. And then I'm just showing you some different examples of murals. This is one that I did down in Miami. It's inside of a garden. Same garden on the other wall. I planted that garden with my hands. It's pretty fun. I love gardening. It's another thing that I love to do. This is the Houston and Bowery mural from, I think it's about 3 years ago. It's hard to tell the scale, but if you look at the fire hydrant, you can get a sense of the scale. This was a wall that is actually going down at the moment. I think they're building on it. That Keith Haring had claimed that wall back in probably around 82. And then not long afterwards, I painted it. I should have shown a picture of that when I didn't. But so that wall has become a very iconic wall in the street art graffiti culture. This is a mural back in LA. Tire monsters. And then this is the most recent mural I did, also in LA. I love making murals. It's a whole other way of being. Okay, here we go. This is more recent. I have I'm about to have a show at Honors Gallery, and a big section of this group of work is going to be called Born Again. Basically, I'm finding paintings, these lost, sad, cast-off paintings that no one cares about. I love to add to them. So I'm just going to show you a couple little examples. Now, there's so many paintings that you can find thrown away or thrift stores. And it has to do with my love for discarded things. And not only garbage, but a discarded painting. Thrift store paintings, most people wouldn't consider them art. Some of them are, some of them aren't, but I do have a fascination for these paintings and the fact that somebody put not always love into them, because sometimes they were like, maybe they had 100 on the wall and they did one leaf and went all around the room, and it was like a conveyor belt. But there's a whole story behind these paintings. Who was the person that made them? Where did these paintings hang? And when did they end up in the thrift store or the garbage bin? And I love bringing things back to life. That's the name. What did I call it? Born Again. And I think, okay, that's it. Has it been a half an hour since I started this? More? Okay, good. So now, if anyone has any questions. Okay, that guy first.
Me? Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious to know if you've heard of anything called Discordianism.
Discordianism?
Yeah.
I've never heard of it. What is it?
It's like a religion that's based on chaos.
Oh, really?
Created in the 60s, 70s. So I was just curious to see if that might have...
I need to know more.
It was created by computer programmers and stuff. Pretty interesting. It's based off of the goddess Eris from Greek mythology.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, the whole thing about chaos, it's also in the part of the Bible and the Genesis. When the earth was created, it was formed out of this chaos in the void. So I do believe that in the chaos is a place where creation happens.
And I saw some of the symbols you put. I'm just curious to know why you put the symbol of the Seal of Solomon or the Star of David.
Which symbol?
The Star of David.
Where did I have that?
On your
second or third picture.
Yeah, there's the one with your
pups. Jetson.
Yeah, Jetson.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm in that philosophy. I'm talking about religions and why people need religion and what it is about religion, and that's why I had the Star of David in there.
And the same picture he's talking about with all the verbiage. I was just wondering if, when you wrote mushroom, if that was the bomb or the drug you were taking at the time.
Well, the mushroom cloud obviously is the name of the bomb, but I do believe that certain psychoactive materials can bring you to places that you can't normally get to in everyday life. And I believe that we have these medicinal plants for a reason. And it's not like I'm taking mushrooms every day. I don't really do much of that anymore. But I did experiment with that when I was younger, and it really did teach me a lot. I used them to go to other worlds, and it taught me a lot. While I was reading about Jung and symbology, and one of the symbols that I fixated on, that I've always, it's always kind of flown off my hand, is a spiral. And I've always been into spirals, and what I love about spirals is they're found everywhere. Nature creates spirals, but also the spiral is something that is a portal, like, for instance, a bathtub. It's the portal where you're going from one world into another world. So something that I found out only recently was that there is something called the Fibonacci sequence, which is the mathematical sequence for the spiral. Now, I happen to be born on 11-23-58. Well, 1-1-2-3-5-8 is the beginning of the Fibonacci sequence. And I just thought, wow, that's really cool that I chose the spiral as my main symbol without even knowing that I was born on the day of the Fibonacci sequence. So I think that spirals are a very, very powerful and important symbol. Both of you, one at a time.
How important was Scene Club 57 in bringing together the generation of artists?
How important was Club 57? Club 57 was a, if people that don't know, was a little basement of a Polish church in the East Village that I happened to run into hanging out in the street with Keith Haring and a couple other artists, John Sex and this other guy, Juice Straub. We went into the basement, we saw a jukebox, we started, oh, these songs are good. We put the music on, and I don't know if you ever heard of the artist Ann Magnuson, but she was there. She was the proprietor of this little basement church, of the church. Don't ask me why there was a bar in the basement of a church. It was 1978, and New York was a very different place. But Club 57 was a very, very important and seminal place where it was. Every single night, there was something amazing going on. Seven nights a week, there was art shows, there was performances, there was music. It just kind of happened. Like, all these kids, including me, we all came to New York in the late 70s with, you know, a dream. And I don't know, some people had some money, but many of us didn't. I didn't really have any money, but it was... It was, New York was a place back then, not now, where you could arrive with no money, with a dream, and meet people in the street and start to make that happen. And it just was one of those things, and I consider myself very lucky to be a part of this, that I met all these people. There was Keith Haring, there was Basquiat, there was Anne, there was numerous other artists. And we all just found ourselves hanging out in this place, and we were like, let's put on a show. We all had these dreams. We wanted to get in galleries. We wanted to, you know, be in a band. We wanted to do this and this and that. Well, no one was opening the doors for us. So what did we do? We just did it ourselves. We did it for each other. And it was an amazing breeding ground, and... It only lasted maybe 2 years, but there was a lot of amazing things going on and a lot of amazing people. And hopefully, I don't want to say too much, but there's a show coming up about Club 57 taking place in a major museum, but I don't want to say it yet, in New York, which will celebrate Club 57. And you can learn more about it. But I feel very, very lucky that I was a part of that. And the things that I learned and the people that I met are very much, even if they're not alive, They're still much a part of me today and my whole philosophy of why I do what I do.
Did you ever get carpal tunnel syndrome from spray cans?
Actually, in the old days, we used to use Krylon paint, and you had to really press hard to make the paint come out. And yeah, my hand would basically feel like it was going to fall off after one painting. But now they make these newfangled paint, which if I learning on the Krylon, this stuff is so easy, it's not even funny. And I can do a whole mural in a week, and my hand doesn't hurt at all. So, good innovations. Yeah.
Can you speak about how important art is in today's generation, and how, like, within the younger generation, why the importance of education and educating the political realm as to why it's as important as it's not, why is it so important? Street art, graffiti art, there's different types of art, you know. But can you speak on that a little bit from your angle, from your opinion?
Well, that question I could probably talk for a couple hours on, but it saddens me how art has been taken out of this education and school system. When I was a kid, I really wasn't very excited about math or English or, you know, the subject. What really got me excited was I got to go and make art in school. It is such an important part of your brain and in development as a child to be able to take your imagination and go places. And I really feel sad that kids today might not know they have this outlet. Obviously, you don't need school to do art. You can do it anytime. But the fact that it's in school, it's a reason for kids to want to go to school. And without that, it's like, it's dead. I really feel like art and music and all of the creative art is as important for opening up your mind to teach you how to become a happy individual and a way for you to express yourself. It's like number one. So, I mean, I could go on and on. And as far as graffiti and street art goes, you know, not all the little kids running around, they live in a lousy apartment, and their surroundings might be really depressing. Well, if they see something in the street that might inspire them, or if they see a car, like, how many cars are there? There are cars everywhere. Cars are boring. Well, I can only do my little part, but I notice when I'm driving in my car bomb car, little kids, often adults don't see things. They don't look. But kids are looking. And kids take in, and when they see something and it sparks their imagination, I feel really good. I feel like if I can help any kid open their mind up and give them a little inspiration, open up their imagination, you know, I feel really great about that. And I feel that without that, what do these kids have? I mean, really, I feel really strongly about that.
Could you talk about your shirt?
My shirt. Okay. This was a design from a painting originally. I don't know if you ever heard the designer Stephen Sprouse. May he rest in peace. He was a big designer in New York in the 80s, and he used this design in his clothes. Actually, he was about to do the show, and then his business went kaputs right before this came out. And then this shirt I'm wearing is a recent design. Well, the clothes, the fabric I did, is the designer Jeremy Scott. So he took my old Stephen Sprouse fabric, and he made this, and I thought I should wear it tonight. Anybody else?
He seems like a eternal optimist. Even with mushroom clouds, you see a better future, but it's still in the 50s. Has your view of the future been shaped at all by current events? To reflect it in painting?
Well, yes, I am an optimist. If I wasn't an optimist, I don't know how I would get up every morning and do what I do. That is what I am. I'm an optimist. But at the same time, I'm very aware of what is going on, and I have the things that we're witnessing today are really, really frightening. And there are no surprises. What we're being confronted with the climate change, with I think that's our number one issue that we're all going to be dealing with, because that will affect every single thing, food and water. These are things that we've known about for a long time. I grew up in the 60s when the ecology movement was born, and I was very much influenced and inspired by the ecology movement, and all these predictions they were giving us back then about the overpopulation, about our resources. We've known about this a long time. We've known that we have to get off petroleum, what it's doing. Yet, it's very, very frustrating to me to see, even though we know we're going in the wrong direction, it almost seems like we're powerless to stop these other powers that don't want these innovations to take place. For instance, there have been in the 70s, there was a gas crisis. All of a sudden, gas was very short, and I don't know if it was the whole country, but in California, you could only fill up your tank on even days with your license plate, and there were lines around the block to get gas. And all of a sudden, people started thinking about solar energy, and cars got smaller, and people started thinking other alternative ways. Solar energy was born, and then I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden SUVs and Hummers came about, and everybody forgot about that. And here we are today. We are starting to see a lot of the predictions happening. And as you said, I am an optimist. I actually have two grandkids, and the thought of I'm afraid for them, for the world that they will inherit. So this is something that is constantly on my mind. And when you see a lot of my art, a lot of people will see the surface and they think, oh, it's happy and it's fun. But if you choose to look further, there's a lot of very, very dark and scary subjects that I tackle. But I like to, I don't want to hit you over the head with it. So I'm obsessed with the dangers that is going around all the time. And I will continue to be an optimist. But at the same time, I am frightened. And I feel like I really don't know how to make the change take place. I wish I personally could do it. I know that the only way that's going to happen is if everyone starts to get really angry. And one thing that made me kind of hopeful was a recent protest in New York where I was 200,000 people were marching in the street. I think we need to really get on this kind of thing. I think the powers and the politicians don't want the change. I feel like the corporations are really stuck on the petroleum industry, keeping things as they are. And I know that there's a lot of what happens is, say in the 70s, inventions that were created for alternative ways of fuel and things like that quickly bought up by the automobile corporations, by the petroleum companies, and shelved. So the person became rich, yet the world didn't get to have these inventions be made. Continue using fossil fuels, heading us in what I think is a very, very scary place. So let's be optimistic, but let's get mad, you know?
One more. Well, I'm going to change the subject, but before I do, just so you know, you're in fracking country.
I know that.
I wanted to ask you, so apparently, you know, it's very obvious that you have made your profession as a, you're a professional artist, and you've made it. You're talented and all of that kind of stuff. I won't flatter you, but my question is, what other aspects, maybe compared to some of your colleagues, do you have that made you maybe more successful or even profitable or, you know, to make a living off of being an artist? Because I'm sure that some of those people that you know back in, you know, the New York days, they're not at the same space where you're at. And so can you just kind of share maybe personality traits or anything like that?
As far as personality traits go, I have two older brothers, and they kind of hated me because I always got what I wanted. But the reason I got what I wanted, because I was the biggest pest in the whole world. So if there was something that I wanted, my parents said no, I would nag the hell out of them. They were so tired of listening to me that eventually they gave in. So basically, perseverance is something. Confidence, you've got to really believe in what you're doing. And also, it also has to do with timing. It has to do with luck. All those things. It's like being a movie star or something. There's only so many people that are going to make it. There might be thousands and millions that are really and truly talented and artists as well. But there's only so many that are going to actually be able to make a living out of it. It's something that I'm aware of, that I'm very grateful for. But at the same time, it's not like I achieved some spot and now I get to rest on my laurels. The thing is about success is you can't let it down. Like, if you let it down, someone's going to knock you down. So it's like the constant thing. You're only as good as your last film or whatever. It's kind of like the same. I'm always looking ahead. I'm not dwelling in nostalgia, even though the show is an 80s show, and I do talk about the past. I'm proud of my past, but I'm not obsessed with my past. I'm always like, I'm like a fighter, you know. I'm like, I don't give up. I'm tenacious, and I'm a pest.
Advice for all artists.
Thank you. That was great.